If you want to keep allowing them to return anything, go ahead. Heck, let them turn in their black and white televisions if you want. All I'm saying is that starting in 1992, you're not going to be returning any of that stuff to us anymore. Although it had become one of those meetings where hands inadvertently curl into fists, there was enough respect between the two companies for things to end on a more positive note. Give us the holiday break to think about it, okay? The VP said. Sure thing, Main said. And call us with any questions, Parrotsman added. The guys from Nintendo bid adieu to their hosts and then caught a plane headed east, girding themselves for the same uncomfortable conversation with the next retailer on their list. Well, Parrotsman said as he raised an airplane-sized bottle of vodka, I don't think the retail community will ever vote Nintendo as most popular. No, sir, Main said, raising his own tiny bottle of vodka. But let me tell you, it sure is a hell of a lot better to be the guy with a target on his back than one of the guys who has already been shot down. They tapped their drinks together and toasted to the virtues of persistence, resilience, and misconstrued arrogance. Shortly after the holiday, Target requested another meeting, and also requested that Arakawa be there. With the beginning of the year chaotic for both companies, they decided to meet in Las Vegas on the eve of the Consumer Electronics Show. The discussion was set to begin around 7:30 p.m. in Peter Main's hotel suite at Caesar's Palace, but because of a snowstorm in Minnesota, the executives from Target were delayed. At some point, while Main, Lincoln, and Arakawa passed the time, Arakawa decided to curl up on the couch for a nap. Finally, around 10 p.m., the Target guys arrived. After an exchange of apologies and pleasantries, they were ready to get down to business. Except Arakawa was still asleep. Main gently nudged his sleeping boss. Arakawa, come on, pal. Nothing. Main tried again, this time with a little more zest. Arakawa, he said. The guys from Target are here. You need to get up. Without opening his eyes, Arakawa asked if they had changed their minds. With the Target executive sitting only a few feet away, Main replied, They're right over there.
Yes, Arakawa replied. But have they changed their minds?
Main looked at the senior VP from Target for a response. Well, no, the VP said. But that's what we're here to talk about.
Okay, Arakawa said. Then I'm afraid we have nothing to talk about.
The following day, Target made an announcement stating they would no longer be doing business with Nintendo. When pressed for a reason, the only answer they provided was a difference of corporate philosophy. For Nintendo, this news was not ideal, but they considered it nothing more than a temporary nuisance. Innovation always trumps stagnation, and Target would eventually realize the error of their ways. Until then, there was nothing for Nintendo to do but keep their eyes on the prize and keep doing what they thought was right. And if these were the crosses they had to bear, so be it. Setbacks like these irked Peter Main. But one of his talents was the ability to put on blinders when he needed to. So when he delivered his address at Nintendo's 1992 Winter CES event, he was nothing but smiles, sunshine, and sophisticated sarcasm. With one exception. For the first time, Main directly acknowledged his competitor. He openly disagreed with Kalinske's sales figures, debunked his rival's rosy forecast for the upcoming year, and upon introducing one of Nintendo's new peripheral devices, added one more amenity to its list of features. The Super Scope can do it all, Main proclaimed. With a comfortable shoulder mount and an infrared transmitter, Nintendo's newest light gun has pinpoint accuracy from long distances. He then casually pointed the gun toward his competitor's booth. It's also rather perfect for hedgehog hunting. Chapter 23. Sequels, Skirmishes, and Baseball in Seattle. Kalinske sat at his desk, discussing early plans for Sonic 2 with Toyota.
Do you really believe it will be possible, Toyota asked, for us to have the same magic touch as the first time?
Absolutely, Kalinske said. I have no doubt whatsoever. As long as the game is half as good as the first, then we'll make it the most successful launch ever. Trust me. It was a blustery day in late January, but as always, the weather didn't matter. It could have been sunny, snowy, or apocalyptic outside, and that wouldn't have slowed down the scrapping, scheming, and strategizing that went on inside. You realize that without you, none of this would be happening, right? Klinsky asked. You absolutely saved the day.
I just did what was best for the company, Toyota humbly replied, unwilling to let Kalinsky's sentiment rattle his aw-shucks demeanor.
Yes, you did. But in the process, you also saved the day. And I think the only fair thing to do now is buy you a cape.
Like Superman.
Exactly, Kalinsky said. Of course, yours doesn't need to be red like his. The color choice is completely up to you, but whatever you pick, it should match your boots.
Boots too, Toyota asked. Look, I know that I've already thanked you a million times, Kalinsky said, speaking more like a friend than a boss. But you deserve everyone.
Thank you, Tom, Toyota said, sounding more like a friend than an employee.
Seriously, I don't even want to think about the mess we'd be in without Naka, Kalinsky said, shaking his head at how such an alternate future would play out. He was referring to Yuji Naka, the creator of Sonic the Hedgehog, who was known for his genius programming skills, legendary perfectionism, and notorious temper. In late 1991, following Sonic's staggeringly successful release in the United States, and its less overwhelming but still impressive release in Japan, Naka was discontent. He was fed up with Sega of Japan for a variety of reasons, including his financial compensation, around $30,000, though he did later receive bonuses, his treatment by management, which was giving him a hard time for taking 14 months to complete the game as opposed to the standard 10, and for needing a team of 4 people as opposed to the usual 3. Naka was also bothered by the lack of recognition. This game and the whole Sega versus Nintendo debate never would have existed without him, yet he was hardly ever referenced anywhere for his hard work. It's not like he was asking for his name to be in the title, but Sega of Japan wouldn't even allow his name to appear at the end of the game. It was company policy not to credit anyone from the development teams, partially to instill an all-for-one attitude, but mostly to prevent other companies from knowing who did what, which would allow them the chance to poach programmers. Naka understood the policy, but that didn't make it right. Artists sign paintings, writers get bylines, and a movie director's work is hailed as a film by so-and-so. His desire for credit was less about ego and more about peace of mind. Naka felt so strongly that he found a secret way to credit himself and his team. At the end of Sonic the Hedgehog, there's a seemingly blank screen. In reality, however, it's a black screen with black type on it, revealing the names of those that had built the game. Because it was black on black, no player would be able to read this, nor would Sega even be aware that it existed, but Naka and his team would always know. Sega of Japan knew that Naka was displeased with certain aspects of the job, but they were shocked when he unexpectedly quit, exiting Sega just as they were hoping to begin development of a sequel. When Toyota found out about this, he traveled to Japan and met with the now unemployed Naka. With Kalinsky's blessing, Toyota did everything in his power to convince Naka to remain with the company. Naka appreciated the effort, but he'd heard it all before, until Toyota suggested that Naka come to America and make the sequel there. They would pay him more, guarantee him better recognition, and allow him to bring any 10 employees of his choosing. Naka and his team would conduct their work at the Sega Technical Institute, STI, the game studio run by Mark Cerny in Palo Alto. Cerny was a game prodigy famous for creating Marble Madness when he was 16 years old. No doubt Cerny would be a kindred spirit who could help smooth out any wrinkles in the process. Naka accepted Toyota's proposal and came to America with the so-called Sonic Team to create a sequel for fall 1992. Is he happy here? Kalinsky asked now. Naka, I mean.
Toyota closed his eyes and silently laughed to himself.
No, but that's a Naka. He'll never be happy. This is part of his process.
All right, Kalinsky said. Well, don't hesitate to let me know if there's anything I can do to make him less unhappy.
Of course.
I'll check in with marketing to see if they've made any progress on the sequel, Kalinsky said. What about the rest of the development slate? How are we looking?
We're very strong in the original product, Toyota said. But we can use some more intellectual property. I'd like to spend more time in Los Angeles to see what we can get.
Perfect, do it, Kalinske said. Are there any doors you'd like for me to open?
It'd be great if we can get something going with Spielberg, or even Lucas. Toyota's eyes lit up at the mention of the famous directors. I will let you know.
Great, Kalinske chirped, always pleased to show off his Rolodex. Then let's talk pricing for a second. Nintendo responded quicker than we expected, and we need to react. On January 10th, mere months after releasing the SNES, Nintendo dropped the price of their console from $199.95 to $179.95. Peter Mann could claim that Nintendo was crushing Sega all he wanted, Kalinske thought, but a 10% drop like that said otherwise. There were also rumblings from retailers that Nintendo would slash the price even further in the coming months. The price war had begun, and Kalinske looked forward to the many skirmishes ahead. I like where we're at price-wise for the moment, but we need to think about staying aggressive.
How aggressive?
Kalinske did some quick calculations in his head. How about $99.95? Toyota nearly laughed.
Come on, Tom.
Not right away, Kalinske said defensively, but Toyota remained unconvinced. Fine. Let's discuss with Paul and get sales and marketing to weigh in. Either way, we should look to have something ready for Boca.
Kalinske was referring to Boca Raton, the site of the first annual Sega Summit.
Though Sega had found success at CES and can now be considered a big fish in the big consumer electronics pond, Kalinske and company thought it would be even better to have a pond all to themselves. Out of this desire came the Sega Summit, where hundreds of retailers would be invited to Florida for a week of fun, sun, and golf, with intermittent presentations for products, sales strategies, and marketing campaigns. The summit's retailer-friendly approach presented another chance for Sega to prove they were the anti-Nintendo, and that they were here to stay. Sega was evolving the industry, and there was now room for two.
That is not much time, Toyota said, now doing some quick calculations of his own.
The Sega summit would begin on May 11th.
But I think we can make it work.
Good, Kalinske said. Speaking of price, has Japan realized yet that they need to be more aggressive themselves? Toyota sighed. But before he could reply, a graceful giraffe scampered into the office. No, actually, it was EBVB, moving at a speed that betrayed her usual elegance. What's going on? Kalinske asked. She ignored him for a moment to pat down his desk in search of something.
Hello, Erinbeth, Toyota said politely.
But he too was ignored as her mysterious quest continued. What do you need? Kalinske asked. She stopped mid-frisk.
I'm looking for your remote control.
Sure, what for? Kalinske said, reaching into his desk drawer.
I would like to perform a magic trick for the both of you, she explained.
In the blink of an eye, I will magically dispel the notion that all press is good press.
Okay, Kalinske said, already smiling as he handed her the remote.
Thank you, sir, she said, turning on the television.
Now, as you can both see, this is an ordinary television, made in Japan, but plays garbage made in America.
She rapidly flipped through the channels before stopping on a news station.
And without further ado, bibbidi-boppidi-boo.
Van Buskirk tried to return the remote to Kalinske, but he was too focused on the breaking story to take it back from her. He could hardly believe his eyes and ears. Howard Lincoln gallantly took the podium at the Madison Hotel Ballroom and announced that executives from several of the area's leading companies would be presenting an offer to buy the Seattle Mariners.
All of the shareholders of the new company will be Seattle area residents, Lincoln stated, and all the decisions will be made here.
He then explained that this newly formed ownership group, the Seattle Baseball Club, would be presenting an offer of $125 million to purchase the team. Unsurprisingly, his remarks set the ballroom filled with businessmen, journalists, and policymakers abuzz. The uproar was partially based on local fervor for the baseball team, but more so because the Seattle Baseball Club's lead investor was Hiroshi Yamauchi, Nintendo's Japanese-born president. And if his bid was accepted, then Yamauchi would become the first non-American to own a piece of America's pastime. In truth, Yamauchi cared little for baseball. His game of choice was Go, the ancient Chinese board game renowned for its difficulty. But despite his lack of interest in balls and strikes, Yamauchi had agreed to bid when Arakawa revealed the opportunity 1 month earlier. Arakawa, like his father-in-law, also lacked a love for the game, but he believed that buying the Mariners and keeping them in Seattle would support a community that had already lost a baseball team once before. It had happened back in 1970, just 1 year after Seattle had gotten their first professional baseball team, the Pilots. Following the Pilots' disappointing inaugural season, the team's owner, Dewey Soriano, realized that perhaps he had bitten off more than he could chew. The team was losing money, primarily because they played their home games at a decrepit minor league stadium that seated only 19,500 and had a reputation for losing water pressure by the seventh inning stretch. It was a bad situation, but help was on the way. Just 1 year earlier, citizens of Washington's King County had approved a bond for $40 million to build a domed stadium, which played a heavy role in Major League Baseball's decision to grant Seattle a team in the first place. The stadium was expected to be complete by 1972, at which point the franchise would likely recoup its losses and begin to flourish. Soriano, however, couldn't afford to wait. The ownership group had already run out of money by the end of the season, and with a recent petition by stadium opponents delaying construction, Soriano wanted out. After the season, he engaged in a series of secret meetings with former Milwaukee Braves minority owner Bud Selig, who was leading an effort to bring baseball back to Wisconsin. Several weeks later, during Game 1 of the World Series, Soriano agreed to sell the Pilots to Selig for $10.8 million. Despite having a deal in place, baseball's owners voted down the sale as a result of vigorous pressure from Slade Gorton, Washington's attorney general. Gorton believed that Seattle was being swindled, and he refused to allow the city to lose what it had fought so many years to get, especially when they had already earmarked $40 million in public funds to build a multi-purpose stadium. Gorton urged a wealthy community member to buy the team, and he got his wish when Fred Danz, a local movie theater chain owner, stepped up to the plate. Danz strongly believed that having a major league team would make Seattle a major league city, and he also felt that the domed stadium would bring a lot of revenue and jobs into the community. In November 1969, Dan signed a contract to buy the team for $10 million and was quickly approved by the American League, but 1 month later, the deal fell through when he revealed that he didn't actually have the money. The drama continued into 1970, and in early March, the Pilots reported for spring training, still unsure where they would play. With the season scheduled to begin in weeks, the owners granted approval to the original deal they had nixed, which would move the team to Milwaukee. Once again, Gorton protested. He filed an injunction on March 16th to stop the deal, but his legal action was trumped by another. Soriano's ownership group filed for bankruptcy and announced that they would be unable to pay coaches, players, and office staff. Up until this point, the team's equipment had been sitting in Provo, Utah, where drivers awaited instructions on whether they should drive to Seattle or Milwaukee. They got their answer on April 2nd, when the Pilots were officially declared bankrupt, 5 days before the season was set to begin. In the next 5 days, Bud Selig, the franchise's proud new owner, changed the team name from the Pilots to the Brewers, in honor of the Milwaukee minor league team that he had cheered on as a boy. Though he was able to change the name, there was not enough time to order new uniforms with the navy and red colors from those Brewers teams of yesteryear. Instead, the newly minted Milwaukee Brewers were forced to adopt the blue and gold of the Seattle Pilots, a color scheme that the team still wears to this day, and on April 7th, this new, old team squared off against the California Angels. They lost 12-0. Though the former Pilots lost the game that day and Seattle was devastated to have lost its chance at becoming a major league city, Slade Gorton refused to throw in the towel. He obtained the services of famed trial attorney Bill Dwyer, and on behalf of the city, they filed a suit against the American League for fraud, breach of contract, and violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act. They claimed that as a result of promises made by Major League Baseball, the city of Seattle had made several large expenditures, notably $1,115,000 to purchase Six Stadium and $1,800,000 more to make improvements demanded by the league. The legal drama persisted for years, until the American League voted on January 14, 1976, to give Seattle an expansion team in 1977. Baseball in the city was officially reborn on April 6, 1977, when the Seattle Mariners, rather fittingly, lost to the California Angels, though by a score of only 7-0 this time. Attorney General Slade Gorton, now a local hero, became Senator Slade Gorton in 1981. And while it's impossible to say that baseball would never have returned to Seattle without his persistence, it's fair to assume that when he watches the Mariners take the field, he feels the pride of a parent watching his son play ball. For this reason, he was particularly troubled to learn on December 6, 1991, that current owner Jeff Smoulian had given up on Seattle and would be moving the team to Florida unless a local investor bought the team by March 6, 1992. His ultimatum tugged at the city's heartstrings, but despite communal love for the Mariners, nobody seemed willing to make a bid for the team. Until Arakawa, who understood the emotions at stake, brought the situation to Yamauchi, who agreed to buy the team so that it could remain in the city where it belonged. To Gorton, who received the good news on Christmas Eve, this was utterly incredible. But the exclamation point came with an obvious question mark. Would Major League Baseball approve the sale to a Japanese investor? In order to increase the likelihood of acceptance, he met once again with the same local businessmen who had declined to buy the team earlier and asked these true blue apple pie loving Americans if they would consider purchasing a minority stake. Through these efforts, the Seattle Baseball Club was formed, with Arakawa serving as chairman, Lincoln as its spokesman, and a group of investors that included Hiroshi Yamauchi, Chris Larson, Microsoft's senior program manager, John McCaw, executive vice president of McCaw Cellular, Frank Schrantz, chairman of Boeing, and John Ellis, chairman of Puget Power. Of these seven individuals, only one was not at the press conference, Yamauchi, whose absence further ignited skepticism about Japanese investment in American baseball. After all, the only thing more suspicious than finding an elephant in the room is being invited to an elephant's party and finding no elephant at all. Lincoln was aware of this fact and worked to downplay Japanese involvement with the club's operations. He explained that the financiers were passive investors who intend to leave the operation of the club to professional baseball people. Though concern about foreign ownership would linger through the press conference and likely into the months to come, it was clear that Howard Lincoln was thrilled by this opportunity and the good that Nintendo was able to do for its home state. Unlike Yamauchi and Arakawa, Lincoln loved baseball, so perhaps it was fitting that he was the one up there on the stage. Or perhaps it was more fitting that game-changing news for a team that was born out of a lawsuit would be announced by a litigator whose legal mind was instrumental in building an 8-bit empire that had just shocked a 3-dimensional world. Chapter 24. Hyrin Gifning Sindana. Olufsen's thin fingers danced across the keyboard, the thrill of this ritual evident on his face. From his apartment on New York City's Upper West Side, he spent the morning's pre-dawn hours tapping away with the dizzying grace of a concert pianist. There was a certain satisfaction in seeing one's progress scroll across the screen, as well as the ability to delete unwanted thoughts. Word processors, in a sense, had given man the power to reinterpret the entire human experience. In addition to being a physicist, Olufsen had taken up a side career as a writer. While rising up the ranks at Sony, he continued to pursue his passion for storytelling, and in 1991, the Icelandic publisher Vaka Helgiafel released his first novel, Fyrirgefning Syndanna, The Forgiveness of the Sins. The 286-page thriller tells the story of Peter Peterson, an expatriate businessman living in Manhattan who suddenly passes away. In addition to bequeathing his two children a vast fortune in a Park Avenue apartment, Peterson has also left them a grave secret. They discover a sheaf of pages, written weeks before his death, that reveal a crime of passion committed in the throes of unrequited love, a crime that had burdened Peterson for his entire life. The story they unravel spans their father's boyhood in Iceland, the Nazi occupation of Denmark, and his business career in modern-day Manhattan. Olafsson's debut novel was well-received, drawing comparisons to the work of Ibsen and Dostoevsky, and in December 1991, Fyrin Gefning Sindana was nominated for the Icelandic Literary Prize. Writing and the art of translation were both difficult undertakings, but at least with those endeavors, the artist remained in control of the outcome. The same, however, could not be said about the world of business. Commerce was a kitchen filled with so many cooks, each of varying competence and inclination, that rarely did a dish fully satisfy the diner's hunger. Nowhere had this been more evident than with regard to Sony's future in video games. In June 1991, Nintendo had publicly humiliated Sony. Now, 6 months later, many of Sony's senior executives were pushing to work out a new deal with Nintendo, one that would allegedly offer a non-gaming role. In contrast to the title of his book, Olafsson believed that forgiving Nintendo would put Sony's software aspirations in purgatory and effectively kill any future hardware plans. Though the majority of executives disagreed with Olafsson, he had some strong allies on his side, the most important of which was Sony president Noriko Oga. And it was becoming clear that two distinct forces were growing within Sony. The old guard, who wanted to work with Nintendo or not be a part of this industry at all, and a newer generation who believed that video games were the future of consumer electronics. The old guard held much of the clout, but the newer generation had Oga's support. Eventually, these opposing forces would meet head-on and alter Sony's trajectory. Olafsson did not know when this showdown would occur and where those ripples would leave Sony, but as he typed through the morning, his mind would occasionally drift to business and a plan that he had been developing. It was a strategy that he believed would both appeal to his forward-thinking brethren at Sony and also appease the dinosaurs who wanted to work with a company of Nintendo's caliber. It was a risky plan with lots of moving parts, and the key to making it work hinged on Sega. Chapter 25. Back to Work. Madeline Schroeder pushed a loose strand of hair away from her eyes, squinted in deep thought, and then slowly raised an eyebrow. "The Seattle Koopa Troopas," she said with a cheerful one-upmanship in her voice. "Or even the Seattle Super Koopa Troopas." She sat across from Nilsson in his office, their usual cave for swapping ideas. For the past few hours, they'd been working on an initial marketing presentation for Sonic 2, but it swerved into discussing Nintendo's recent bid for the Seattle Mariners, whether the new ownership group would rename the team, and if so, what that name might be. Nilsson judiciously considered her suggestions, tapped a finger against his chin, and nodded lightly. "Not bad. Not bad at all. What about the Seattle Princess Chasers? Or how about the Tetrises?" she said. "Hmm, well done," he said. "But I think the word you're looking for is Tetri." "Exactly," she said, pointing at him. "The Seattle Tetri. Or maybe they keep it simple. The Super Nintendos," he suggested. "But they change the team name every time they come out with a new console." "I like that," she said. "But I also like the Nintendo Robs. Gives a little shout-out to their forgotten robot from yesteryear." "Why dive so far into yesteryear? How about the Nintendo Power Gloves? Or the Nintendo Power Pads?" Nilsson was about to make a Zelda reference, perhaps something about gold cartridges, perhaps. But suddenly the look in his eyes changed. Schroeder picked up on it instantly. How could she not? She'd practically been in a bunker with Nilsson for the past year, and as a result, their brains had seemingly fused together. Not only did she notice things about him, but sometimes she even noticed them before he did. "You got it, don't you? That perfectly clever conversation-ending idea." He did, and for this reason spoke in a slow, overly dramatic, "I'd like to solve the puzzle" tone. "If Major League Baseball approves the sale, the Seattle Mariners will henceforth be known as the Seattle Mariners." "The Mariners?" she asked, feeling like she'd missed the joke. "That's boring." "Exactly," Nilsson said. When was the last time Nintendo did something other than maintain the status quo? 2 weeks before never? Spot on. Shame on us for ever thinking otherwise, she said with a laugh. I think the better question is, what would the San Francisco Giants be called if SOJ bought them? Nilsson considered this. It certainly is a better question, I'll give you that, he said. But I refuse to answer on moral grounds. Oh, yeah? She asked. And why is that? Because as cool as it would be for Will Clark to bet third for the San Francisco Sonic Speedsters, we should never resort to following Nintendo's footsteps. Originality or bust, he proclaimed. But a football team, on the other hand... When the banter finally came to an end, they resumed their conversation about marketing plans for the Sonic sequel. The game was scheduled to be ready by October, but Schroeder believed it would more likely be November. Since Naka and the rest of his Sonic team had begun working on the game at the Sega Technical Institute, she'd been driving out to Palo Alto once or twice a week to check on its progress. The game was obviously in its earliest stages, just character sprites and background art, but she could tell that it wasn't going to be simply a hastily made rehash of the first game. That had been her biggest fear, and the biggest problem with sequels in general. Even Nintendo had experienced this conundrum years earlier. After the release of Super Mario Bros., the game's creator, Shigeru Miyamoto, got to work on a follow-up. After nearly a year of work, he delivered a game that many felt was too much like the original, just much more difficult. Nintendo of Japan released the game in 1987 to mixed reviews. Nintendo of America, however, disliked the game so much that they postponed the U.S. release and decided instead to find a different, already completed Japanese game and simply revise it in Mario's image. They ended up settling upon an Arabian-themed game called Doki Doki Panic, which follows a family of four on a perilous quest to rescue kidnapped kids from Wart, an evil frog king who has an intense allergy to vegetables. Nintendo of America then made superficial changes to the game, like swapping out the original characters of Mama, Papa, and children Lena and Imogene for respectively Luigi, Toad, Princess Toadstool, and Mario. When the redevelopment was complete, Nintendo of America released their version of Super Mario Bros. 2 to generally positive reviews, but a lingering popular sentiment that the game felt off. Schroeder didn't know which scenario was worse, a sequel that felt too similar, or one that felt too different. But despite concerns about sequel-itis lingering in the back of her mind, everything she had seen thus far from Sonic 2 looked very promising. The game was a bit faster and a bit more colorful, and she had recently heard it might even feature a sidekick for Sonic. Plus, this time around, the developers were located mere miles away, which would make any concerns, disputes, or cultural disagreements that much easier to resolve. She was cautiously optimistic about the sequel, and that filled her and Nilsson with a desire to develop a marketing program that was as good as they hoped the game would be. Maybe we should send Sonic to retailers a few months before the release, Schroeder suggested, and he can show off demo versions of the game. I like that, Nilsson said. Add it to the list under in-store promotions. They'd spent weeks putting together a preliminary marketing plan, which they'd be presenting at the next day's senior staff meeting. The strategy they'd come up with looked like a shinier and more pervasive version of how they had launched the first Sonic game. Magazine coverage, radio promotions, and maybe even a mall tour around the Christmas season. There was nothing wrong with what they'd put together, but as Nilsson looked over the list, he felt greatly underwhelmed. He shook his head, angry with himself for doing what had already been done, even if it had been he himself who had done it the first time. "This isn't good enough, Mad," Nilsson said. "It just isn't." "Which part in particular?" Schroeder asked. "All of it," he said, still shaking his head. "This just isn't good enough. You were okay with it 10 minutes ago. Maybe we should start over from scratch." "You're joking, right?" she said. Not at all amused. "This is weeks of work. Half of it yours, by the way. I don't care," he said. "It's not good enough. It's not big enough. What do you want, Al? A monument?" she asked, getting annoyed. Blimp? "I don't know," Nilsson said, trying to piece together his thoughts. "I have an entire list of ideas right here. This is what we're going to present tomorrow, and trust me, everyone's going to love it. But it's not Sonic-worthy, Mad. It just isn't. It's Mario-worthy. I don't know what you want from me. I want you to help me come up with something better. There is nothing better. This is everything we've got, the kitchen sink. Fine, Nilsson said. Then I want the whole kitchen.
Their conversation soon escalated into a shouting match, with Schroeder yelling at Nilsson and throwing reason and rational thinking at him, and him refusing to listen or offer any better suggestion. In 2 years of working together, this was the first time they had ever raised their voices to each other. Though they disagreed before, there'd always been the common bond of logic and reason to keep heads cool and smiles on their faces. This time, though, the bickering got so loud that employees stopped outside their office and peered inside to make sure everything was okay. Nilsson saw them watching, their eyes filled with a concern that in the moment he interpreted as taking joy in his failure. He wanted to shout at them to look away, but he knew that he wasn't really mad at them. He wasn't even really mad at Madeline. He was mad at himself. Mad that his brain had stopped cooperating. Mad that he had failed to come up with an elegant solution to the impossible question.
You're not listening to a single thing I have to say, Schroeder shouted. Maybe it would be better if we each present our own plan and let them choose. Oh, yeah? Nilsson asked, his face reddening by the moment. Maybe a better idea would be if...
He stopped mid-sentence, and a maniacal smile began to form.
You figured it out, didn't you? She asked, her voice returning to a normal level.
Nilsson nodded slowly. People outside the office were still looking at him, but now he welcomed their watchful eyes.
So? Schroeder asked. What is it?
We're going to start in Japan, move to Europe, and then end in the U.S. No trucks, no boats. Everything will be delivered by plane exactly one day before. We're going to have a street date, Mad. We're going to have the world's first global launch, and in the process, we're going to break every single sales record. What do you think?
What do I think? She mused.
I think a global launch is Sonic-worthy. And just like that, it was decided. They scrapped their previous plans and started planning the video game world's first ever street date. The idea started flowing. The faucet of ideas was turned on full blast, and their minds melded into one. Movies come out on Friday, but this should be different, definitely. How about Thursday or Saturday? No, it should be Tuesday, and we'll call it Sonic Tuesday.
That's perfect. Wow, you're too smart.
Aw, shucks, you're too kind.
As they came up with each pun, they started typing it on Nilsson's computer, printing it out, and taping it to the wall. Soon enough, the office walls were covered.
Too fast, too rad, today.
They kept going, the pages pouring out of the printer until there was no more space on the walls.
Now what? Schroeder asked. Too bad for us?
Nilsson got up and went into Van Buskirk's office next door.
Do you mind if Matt and I start taping things to the window outside your office?
That's a new one, Van Buskirk replied.
No, I don't mind, but I would not mind even more if I knew why you were doing this.
Of course, Nilsson said, waving for her to follow him back to his office.
We're going to do the first international global launch. We're going to shatter every record, and it's all going to happen on Sonic Tuesday.
Van Buskirk entered his office and saw all the puns taped to the walls.
For the record, Schroeder said, we're just a little insane, but not clinically or anything like that.
Van Buskirk looked at Schroeder, then back at the wall, and then moved to Nilsson's computer. She typed up something quickly, printed it out, and then taped it to the window outside her office. Too cool. With three crazy people hanging up puns everywhere, it didn't take long for their happy insanity to spread. Employees started migrating over from all around the office, coming up with their best puns and hanging them on the window. Nilsson took a step back and watched the impromptu collage come together, too impressed to speak. He then got over himself and went back to work. Bill White had suddenly become a very popular guy.
and he didn't like it one bit.
No comment, White said into the phone,
and he said it again twice more before the reporter gave up and thanked him for his time. He looked around his messy office, shook his head in disbelief, and wondered how many minutes it would be until the next call came in.
Since the press conference the day before, Nintendo's marketing director had been flooded with calls from reporters around the country. What did Nintendo hope to gain from owning a baseball team? Would the team be renamed the Seattle Super Marios? And if so, was there any concern that the new name would sound too similar and possibly upset the local pro basketball team, the Seattle Supersonics?
White tried to clarify that it wasn't actually Nintendo buying the team, but rather Nintendo's owner, Hiroshi Yamauchi. He would own the Mariners the same way he owned a variety of other businesses in Japan, and he was only putting up 60% of the money, with the other 40% coming from local investors who wanted to keep the team in the city. But those facts didn't make for good headlines, so the reporters didn't care. And honestly, White didn't care either. He'd thought this was a bad idea from the beginning. And it was even worse now that baseball's commissioner, Faye Vincent, had weighed in. Less than 24 hours after Yamauchi's bid was submitted, Vincent cited a strong policy against foreign ownership and coldly deemed the deal unlikely. The folks at Nintendo were disheartened by his quick response, but White didn't understand how they could expect any less. After all, only a year before, some Japanese businessman had inquired about purchasing an available minority stake in the New York Yankees. Any prospect of such a deal was nixed immediately, with Steve Greenberg, baseball's deputy commissioner, explaining that baseball policy prohibited non-North American ownership. That was all before Japan balked at providing aid to the Gulf War effort, and U.S. politicians took to blaming Japan for America's current recession. Since then, things had only gotten worse. Just 2 days earlier, the Los Angeles County Transportation Commission had been nationally applauded for voting to cancel a $122 million railcar deal with the Sumitomo Corporation, a Japanese firm that had won the contract over a company in Idaho. Video games are no longer the fastest-growing medium of entertainment. That honor now went to xenophobia, with Japan bashing being the most popular game. It also didn't help that Yamauchi, the man at the center of this story, was considered to be a frigid, enigmatic corporate tightwad. Only 2 years earlier, he had responded to inquiries about Nintendo's noticeable lack of philanthropy by saying, "I believe a business can contribute to society by growing and making money and paying more taxes. That's how we contribute to society." Given that previous stance, it was unsurprising that Americans would suspect an ulterior motive behind this out-of-the-blue act of supposed charity. Of course, they would think, here comes Japan, this Godzilla-sized bully. They show up in our country and take over our precious national pastime. As irrational as that point of view might be, the nation was angry, looking for someone to blame, and Yamauchi wasn't doing himself any favors by skipping the press conference and avoiding the American media. The only public statement he made on the matter was to Japan's Yomiuri newspaper, saying simply, "This is a kind of social service, not a business activity intended to make a profit." Another call to Bill White. "No comment, no comment, thank you for your time." All of this couldn't have come at a worse time for Nintendo, which had recently lost the very American ace that had been up their sleeve for years, Howard Phillips. Nintendo would often parade Phillips with his curly red hair, boyishly thin freckled face, and gaudy bow tie in front of the press to provide a familiar-looking face for a mistrusted Japanese company. He was the go-to guy for interviews, the physical embodiment of Nintendo in most of the population's minds. Officially, Phillips was Nintendo's Game Master, a tribute to his ability to select hit titles and beat any game. But over the years, his job had morphed into serving as the company's unofficial mascot and a role model for a generation of young gamers. Phillips spoke in a fun, fresh parlance that resonated with kids of all ages, and he talked constantly about how he had the coolest job in the world. But in March 1991, he had unexpectedly left Nintendo. White didn't know all the details behind his departure, but he wished that Phillips was around right now to help cushion the blow. Without Phillips in the picture, Yamauchi's bid for the Mariners had reopened the greatest hits lists of problems from Nintendo's past, the lawsuits with Atari, Tengen, and Galoob, a discrimination case from 1990, alleging that Nintendo had repeatedly failed to hire and promote qualified African Americans, and a failed venture in Minnesota that would have allowed individuals to purchase lottery tickets through the NES, which the press was using to paint Nintendo as a proponent of gambling. This festering negativity would eventually cut into Nintendo's bottom line, which was already suffering as a result of the recession, lack of a must-have title, and the presence of additional options in the marketplace. Less than a month after the holiday season, in addition to dropping the price of the Super Nintendo from $199.95 to $179.95, it had also dropped the price of its handheld Game Boy from $99.95 to $89.95. Another call. This one from White's wife. "Will you be home for dinner tonight?" "No comment," he replied. "That kind of day, huh?" "You can't even imagine," he said. "I should be home by 9, provided Nintendo doesn't go ahead and buy a football team." White understood the good intentions behind purchasing the Mariners, but surely Arakawa couldn't be naive enough to believe that the country would see the situation from his point of view. He wanted to give his boss the benefit of the doubt, but that was becoming harder to do, as it became more and more clear that he and Arakawa suffered from irreconcilable philosophical differences. In short, the issue was that White was a classically trained student of advertising who believed in the divine power of marketing, while Arakawa was a master of product development who believed that marketing was pretty much a complete waste of time. This was particularly troubling to White in light of the fact that he was, you know, Nintendo's director of marketing. Though Arakawa's perspective may have seemed short-sighted, there was an anecdotal basis to his outlook. Over the past decade, he'd heard from focus groups that the NES would never sell in America, that The Legend of Zelda was much too confusing, and that an Italian plumber made for a terrible hero. Experiences like these led him to believe that the fundamental problem with marketing was its reliance on the past. It looked backward, not forward, and failed to take into account innovation, trends, or cultural shifts in taste. At the end of the day, the only true predictor of future success was the quality of a product. In short, the reason a game sells is because it's a good game, not because Bill White tells people to buy it. Though the differing philosophies occasionally produced friction over the years, it was never anything that didn't evaporate in a day or two. After all, why bother blowing gaskets or holding grudges when things were going so well? But as Nintendo shifted to 16-bits, and the era of good feelings came to a close, blind faith was gradually replaced with muted skepticism. Fingers that once had seemed to have that Midas touch were now being pointed to allocate blame. And as the company began to lose market share, White found himself disagreeing more and more with Arakawa and the direction that Nintendo was headed. Ultimately, though, his concerns didn't matter much. Arakawa was Nintendo of America's president, and his opinion was the magic wand that enchanted everyone and everything into action. Nothing exemplified the growing divide greater than how Nintendo responded to the emergence of Sega. For the past year, Sega had been going directly after Nintendo, naming names, trashing games, and making all kinds of bogus claims. At first, it was almost cute. They're yippity-yapping about how Genesis does what Nintendo don't, like a toy poodle barking in the face of a Great Dane. It was a nuisance, yes, but White knew it wasn't worth the energy to fight them off. But then, Tom Kalinske took over, and that poodle turned rabid. Sega lowered their price, signed up third-party developers, and painted Nintendo as nothing more than a cutesy kids company. Their bark was still much greater than their bite, but it was loud enough to warrant a response. Now was the time to put Sega in their place, either by launching a campaign that bit them right back, or by feeding them some scraps and sending them away from the table. But this was not the Nintendo way. They refused to stoop to unsavory levels and negotiate with marketing terrorists. Sega realized that they could do or say whatever they wanted without fear of retribution. At the Consumer Electronics Show, Sega had thrown Mario into a foot race with their too cool blue hedgehog. Nintendo did not respond. Then they took their parlor trick on the road, setting up their side-by-side comparisons around the country. Still, Nintendo did not respond. And then over the holiday season, Sega took things to the next level, airing negative ads, puffing up their numbers for the press, and continuing to find ways to exploit their new mascot, who is nothing more than a Mario ripoff in fast shoes. Once again, Nintendo did not respond. Looking back, White couldn't believe that Nintendo would let this happen. Sega was nothing but a one-trick pony who had fooled the world into believing their hype. If only his bosses had allowed him to bark back, then they could have sent Sega to the woodshed before they became an actual threat. But now it was probably too late. White would never really know for sure, and that was the worst part. Even after everything Sega had done, Arakawa still refused to fight fire with fire. Though he had opened Nintendo's purse strings and allocated $25 million to market the SNES, that money was earmarked for a wholesome, kid-friendly gee-whiz campaign, which played right into Sega's hands. But Arakawa wasn't too concerned. He would forever be a slow and steady wins-the-race kind of guy, patiently hoping that the 90s would turn out to be as much of a fairy tale for Nintendo as the 80s had been. Only time would tell, but there was one key difference between now and then. The reason that Nintendo had pulled off the impossible in the 80s was because they had fought for every inch. Now, though, they were sitting back and letting others take their precious real estate. Nintendo had underestimated Sega, undervalued backward compatibility, and underrated the importance of Howard Phillips' freckled face. They were slightly wounded, but still very much the market leader. If they wanted to remain king of the jungle, then they should be spending their time searching for that same fighting spirit, not buying baseball teams. It was time for Nintendo to get back to work. What was done, however. And White was willing to adopt the key tenet of Arakawa's philosophy. Look forward, not backward. The bid for the Mariners had already been made, and the only thing they could do now was damage control. For the deal to go through, it would have to be approved by the commissioner, the ownership committee, and at least 75% of the 26 Major League Baseball teams. At this point, White didn't know which of the two evils would be better, suffering through months of bad press only to watch the deal fall apart, or miraculously receiving ownership of the team and exposing the company to continued attacks. He started to give this question some serious thought, but was interrupted once again by a ringing phone. Chapter 26. Origin Stories. Kalinske didn't mean to stare. It was against his nature to gawk at others. But he simply couldn't help himself when glancing at Howard Phillips, whose neck was noticeably lacking a big bright bow tie. The post-Nintendo Phillips looked older, wiser, and less two-dimensional. It was as if Charlie Brown had upgraded from his everyday yellow shirt with the black zigzag to a special occasion navy sport coat. It was only a small change, perhaps, but it represented a redefinition of character. Howard Phillips was all grown up now. And the only thing that epitomized that maturation more than a revised fashion sense was the fact that he had come to San Francisco for a celebratory dinner with Kalinske and Toyota. "For the sake of decorum," Phillips said, speaking with a delicate cadence that seemed to expertly bend the English language, "I would like to express right off the bat that I have nothing but the utmost respect for Nintendo and my former colleagues." From across the table, Kalinske and Toyota nodded in unison. This was too fine a restaurant and too fine an occasion to let things devolve into a gossip session. Tonight was about one thing and one thing only: finalizing the deal for Nintendo's former game master to come work at Sega.
"Of course," Toyota said. "We will not speak ill of our competitor."
"The truth is that we have tremendous respect for Nintendo as well," Kalinske said. "It's just that, unlike you, we also despise them." Phillips chuckled. As he did, Kalinske couldn't help but notice a slight disconnect between the simplicity of his bulging smile and the complexity in his eyes. Perhaps Phillips harbored more of a grudge than he let on. "Speaking of the devil," Kalinske said, "how'd you even wind up there?"
"It all began a long, long time ago," he said, his eyes suddenly shining.
It was undoubtedly a tale he told many times before, but also undoubtedly one that he loved even more with each retelling. When he spoke, it was like a superhero revealing his origin story, the legend of how it all began. Over the next decade, there would be many tales filled with the pow, bam, zap of success, but nothing would ever rival that initial experience. At the time, I was just a student at the University of Washington. It was 1982, and one day my good friend, my roommate actually, Don James, got a job with this small, nondescript company that had set up shop in the Southern District of Seattle.
Nintendo, Toyota asked.
Bingo, Philip said. They had been importing these giant refrigerator-sized arcade cabinets from Japan until they realized it would be cheaper to simply send over the parts and have someone put the things together over here. So Don got hired on to do that job. And then after a couple of months of him putting these things together, they decided they wanted someone to keep track of these things. So they asked me if I wanted a job, and just like that, I became the warehouse manager.
Philip shook his head.
There couldn't have been more than 10 of us back then. Myself, Don, and Mr. Arakawa, and a few other helping hands. Who could have predicted what would happen next?
As Phillips told the story, Kalinske couldn't help but feel a sense of compassion for Nintendo. It was like hearing about Goliath's early years, when he was just a skinny kid who liked skipping rocks and making macaroni art. The fact that Phillips had been there since the beginning made Kalinske feel even better about bringing him to Sega. It would hurt Nintendo that much more.
"Here I am," Phillips went on, "just some kid working in the warehouse. And one day Mr. A comes to me, shows me this game with a funny name, Donkey Kong, and says, 'What do you think about this?' He wants to know because the company isn't doing so great and they want the next arcade game they bring in to be a big smash hit. So I turn it on and start playing the game, and a minute or so later I just blurt out, 'Mr. Arakawa, we gotta bring this to the United States.' Now, obviously I'm not saying that I'm the reason that they chose to import Donkey Kong, but I will say that the version of the game I played that day was not the same one that we sent out for people to play. Through trial and error, I made some tiny tweaks to adjust for difficulty, timing, number of lives, that sort of thing. From then on, Mr. A would always come to me and ask if a new game was cool or if it sucked, what needed to be done to make it better, why wasn't this as fun as it should be. It was a dream come true. I was like a focus group of one. This was the real reason that Sega wanted Phillips. Yes, it would be satisfying to steal away Nintendo's former mascot, but by this point, Sega was past high school pranks and focused on going from good to great. Phillips, for whatever reason, had an unquantifiable superhero-like ability to determine the anatomy of great, and Sega needed this now more than ever. That was why Toyota had been wooing him for many months. For a long time, his overtures had been respectfully declined, but as Sega continued to trend upward, Phillips couldn't help but seriously consider the opportunity. After leaving Nintendo, Phillips did not find the grass to be any greener at Lucasfilm Games. Less than a year later, he moved on to THQ, whose grass also wasn't tinted to his liking. By this time, Sega's offer to lead a development team and produce games was looking pretty good. In fact, it looked great. But Phillips was trying his best not to see it that way. As wonderful as the opportunity appeared to be, he couldn't wrap his brain around joining the dark side. The games that Nintendo made were treasures that could be enjoyed by the whole family. No sex, no gambling, no violence. But Sega did things differently. Although they hadn't specifically set out to publish unsavory content, by transforming themselves into the anti-Nintendo, Sega had become the primary outlet for more mature content. Onslaught, Streets of Rage, Fatal Labyrinth. Just look at the titles of these Genesis games. Even with Sonic the Hedgehog, a great game for sure, why do they have to give him such a naughty attitude? What kind of values did Sonic teach to kids? Rowdiness, rebelliousness, perpetual impatience? Now, with only 16 bits, perhaps this lack of censorship was no big deal, but as the technology of video games progressed, the differences in philosophy between Sega and Nintendo would only become more pronounced. And yet, even though Phillips felt this way, he had still agreed to join Sega. He resented himself for saying yes to Toyota, and cringed a little bit while driving to that night's dinner, but working for them would be better than his current position at THQ, and there didn't appear to be any other options. It was a bitter pill for him to swallow, but he promised himself that he would effect change from inside Sega, act as a moral compass, and stay true to himself. With the success of Donkey Kong, we became the largest